And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker, Sam S. from La Jolla.
Good evening. My name is Sam, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight. I want to thank my good friend Larry for asking me to come down here. And we know each other for a long time. We were pretty much both new when we met. And I think he came in the month of November, and I came in the month of December to Alcoholics Anonymous. He has not let me forget that who is the newcomer. And he has this tendency to remind me all the time that he's got a month over me. And he's a humble man. And he's very sensitive. I want to thank Liz, our first 10 or 10-minute speaker. You did a great job, you know, and without being nervous and everything, I understand that. And the first time I was 10-minute speaker, I got up and I was so nervous, I couldn't even talk, you know. And I said, can we have a 10-minute silence for the alcoholics who suffer? I get nervous. I have a main problem. Contrary to you, I forget how to speak English. That makes it hard. You know. And Larry called me and says, you live in La Jolla? And I says, yeah, but I'm from San Diego. And you might be able to say from my accent, I'm sure some people are sitting over there, this guy doesn't sound from San Diego either. So I'm not even from the state of California. And I come from East. And I'm not talking about New York. I was born and raised in Tehran, Iran. And our house was, my dad was a high-ranking officer in the military. And that's how the house I was brought up was. Like, you know, I had three younger sisters. And he was the general. My mother was second in command. Me and my sisters were E1s. We did not count at all or anything. And the oldest son, they had a lot of good plans for me. They thought I had potentials, and they sent me to good schools, you know, from the beginning. And I had to study a lot. And I was under a lot of pressure to go to school and get good grades. And I did not pick up alcohol until I went to college. And, you know, the book talks about the dual life the alcoholic leads. And I had the dual life even before I picked up the first drink. And I didn't know that until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to this famous high school back home, and then we didn't have that many opportunities like with all the universities which are available in the United States. You know, over there, I remember that when I graduated from high school, we had to take this national exam to get to university, to college. And the year I graduated, about I think 250,000 students, they took that exam. Only 12,000 got to colleges. So it was such a big deal to pass that exam. And as soon as I passed that exam and I got to college, it seems like all the pressure was gone. And then I went to university, and I started drinking because everybody drank. Everybody was drinking, and I wanted to be like everybody else. Before they going to college, I mean, I was the last person on this planet. Anybody that, you know, I was going to end up an alcoholic or even drinking alcohol or anything. I was such a good boy. I was listening to parents. I was studying a lot. I was a loner. I was an isolator. I read a lot. I read many, many books. And I didn't know these are the signs, you know, that thing Liz was talking about. I never felt part of anything. But at that time, I had no idea that either, you know, this has anything to do with alcoholism. When I got to college, we started, you know, everybody was drinking, and I started hanging around with the guys, and somehow it's like when alcohol got to me, it's like it was dancing, everything got over, everything was okay. And again, I didn't know none of these things until I got to Egghead, that I drank because of the effect of alcohol. I loved alcohol. I hated the taste. I remember, right by the university, there was a bar, and this is before revolution. You know, if somebody's thinking the country was completely different than what we have right now. And I used to go to this bar at 9:30 in the morning. My first class was 10 o'clock in the morning. And I had the bartender, pour me a tall glass of vodka and a couple olives next to it, because that's what I have seen people do. And I just downed that glass of vodka, a couple olives after that. And as soon as I get out of the liquor store, the first 2 weeks, there was an alley right next to it. And I go to the alley, and I throw my guts out. But when it stayed down, it made me feel all right. And, I go to campus, and I could be, I could hang around with everybody. I remember that I was the darling of the university. It's like I hang around with the religious people, with the dorky people who were studying a lot. I could hang around with people who were partying. The alcohol was a social lubricant. It made all these things possible. I was elected as the student senator for the university, and I was enjoying myself. I remember that I started the first time, I think Liz mentioned about something about drugs here, and I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I have to say that I did drugs only once, from 1971 to 1988, continuously. Now, I started smoking pot in the college because when I smoke pot, it's like it made my eyes small and red, and I thought it made me more romantic or something like that. When I was about 16 years old, and my parents were not religious people, and they never drank. They didn't drink at all either. And when I was about 16 years old, I got into religion, and I became like an Orthodox religion. I was going to mosque every day. I wasn't watching movies or anything like that. And then when I went to college, you're talking about in early 1970s, it was a little bit different than now. Everybody was into, they're intellectuals, we went to demonstrations, the Baader-Meinhof and Red Army faction, these are our heroes, and I started reading books about materialism, philosophy, and I got interested in socialism, and somehow I became I was ready to pick up a machine gun and go to fight against, capitalism and all these things, And this was the story of my life. I always was either extreme. I was like a pendulum, either extreme to the left or extreme to the right. I thought the middle is like mediocre. It's like you die, and I enjoyed it. The way I can describe myself is like I saw this bumper sticker a few years ago in La Jolla. I was driving and I could never find that bumper sticker. I would love to buy it if I get it, and it said, it says something like this: if you are not living on the edge, you are taking too much space. And that's how I was. I enjoyed living on the edge, no matter what. And somehow I managed, to get a degree in physics in college, then it was fashionable at that time that they send you to, to abroad, especially coming to the United States. My parents were well off. They were wealthy, for higher education to come to the United States. And my father really wanted me to go to Army. He thought that, that's when you become a man or something. But somehow my mother talked him out of it. And, after I got my bachelor's degree, I came to, I landed in Chicago in 1976. And I went to University of Illinois at Chicago. And somehow I was getting straight A's, for my master's degree, and everything was going good. And I started drinking and partying with everybody. And, they talk about this disease being progressive. And I was drinking more and more, but I could still enjoy it. You know, I think Liz was mentioning that it was, I could manage everything. I could get good grades. I could party. And then after 1 year I was here, my sweetheart from back home from college came here and we got married. And, you know, everything looked great. After a couple of years, you know, we had a son, and I love children. When God gave me a son, you know, I mean, it was, I mean, by this time I was close to the age of 30, and I was, you know, getting, working on my PhD, and, you know, life was great. I could manage the house. I could, you know, my wife was getting her degree, her PhD in the biology, and, you know, we had a beautiful life. But I, you know, it's like, I had to drink more and more. It wasn't just during the weekends anymore. It was during at nights at home. Then I had to go out and drink. And very gradually, it just progressed and progressed. And it came to a point that I drank on a daily basis. And then, and the book talks about being a tight exactly at the wrong time. And I remember that I had to take, after 5 years I had worked on my thesis, you know, I had to take this exam called qualifying exam for preliminary exam for a PhD, and it's a hard exam. You know, they make you, I mean, you have to study for 2 years just for that exam. And, you know, I was, yesterday I was at a meeting, noon meeting, and this guy was talking about, he's about 10 years sober. He was talking about he's into a step study, and the way he's stuck on his fourth step, and he knows he has to do like 2-3 pages, maybe a little bit one at a time. But, you know, he wants to do it all at the same time. For about 4 months, he has been postponing it because he wants to do it all. And I could relate to that. And that's how I tried to do that exam. That, you know, I knew I had to study every day, but I do it, you know, I do it later. And I went to the exam, I think with hangover or drunk. I was drunk either way. The night before, I was drunk. And when I flunked that exam, the first thing came to my mind is they don't understand what a great scientist mind I have. They cannot appreciate me or anything like that. And my drinking got worse and worse. And then when I flunked the exam, then I went to get another degree in engineering at the same university. And, you know, they gave me a laboratory at the college, at the University of Illinois, and I was working on something called high temperature corrosion of ceramics, that I had all this glassware, and these bubbles. And it looks like a Frankenstein movie, like a laboratory, if you look at it. And I had unlimited access source of glassware, which I can use, and this was the time I was introducing to cocaine. And, you know, at that time, you know, we didn't have the rock or crack or something they call it. We call it freebasing at that time. So I did very, very extensive research on that. By this time, I was going to bars every night, and me and my wife, we were separated, and I was living in a hotel. And I thought I was still managing, and because I had my job at university and I was teaching a couple undergrad courses, and you know, then it, you know, and I thought I was the only one who got paranoid before I got to AA. You know, when I was drinking, you know, when I came in and I saw most of the people the same thing, that I used to close the shades and all, you know, you can't look outside. So, you know, Chicago is a little bit different than San Diego. I mean, that's a beautiful city. My son was born over there, and I love Chicago. And the bars are open until 4 o'clock in the morning. On the weekends, they're open at 5 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, then after that, you can. My best buddies were bartenders. I party with bartenders. Then we close the bar, and then we go to the suburbs, and we drink all day, you know. And I was working at the Amoco Corporation, I remember at this time, and, you know, the same thing. I'm up all night partying, you know, and drinking, and then I drive to Amoco Corporation, and I show my face up, and I go to the library, find a corner, and I collapse. And then I get up, and I have a couple more drinks or something, you know, whatever I had in my pocket, I do. Then I show up my face, and then when they fired me, they asked me to leave. The same thing came to my mind. They don't understand what a great scientist I am, and they just fired me. And So I go to bars every night, and I drink until about 5 o'clock in the morning. I have the key for the laboratory at the university, because the university police knows that I'm running experiments. I told them I have to check my experiments, you know, every 2 hours or something. I get paranoid in my apartment. I can't stay over there, so I come to the lab. I feel safe in my lab, and I do whatever I need to do in the lab. And I start drinking and, you know, and smoking until about 7 o'clock in the morning, when the other graduate students, they come in, and, you know, then, you know, I have to leave. I can't stay over there. So it got to a point that after 7 o'clock, I could not stop drinking in the morning. And then, but, you know, when you're smoking this thing, you know, it makes a lot of smoke. You can't just hide it like in a laboratory. So with a great scientist mind I had, I came up with this idea. And because I was working with toxic gases in the lab too, we ordered something called a fume hood, which looked like, you know, this door, you know, this window we have here. And it was a glass door, and it was about 2 feet, 3 feet deep. And then it was the same size, and on the top of it was a big exhaust going all the way to the roof of the science building. And I said, you know, I use that because when I was doing the experiments with the toxic gases, so the fume will come inside. The main purpose of it was, at after 7 o'clock in the morning, I send the graduate students out to do something, and I stick my head inside there so I can smoke the pipe, and the smoke goes outside. That's how the great scientist, where my mind was working. And, you know, that thing cost the taxpayers about $20,000. And I have already made my amends to University of Illinois. That's why I mentioned that. And then after, you know, staying there, and I was going through about, I think, cases like, you know, of test tubes every week, because I used to get paranoid at night, and all this glassware and everything, I used to break it and flush it down the toilet. And so the university, I didn't make no publications, and I was going through all these test tubes. The grant money I had, they asked me, like, why are you spending the money on the test tubes? So anyhow, and my drinking got so bad at this time that I was drinking every hour. I mean, alcohol was not really my problem. Alcohol has never been my problem. Alcohol was my solution. My problem was that I had this deadly obsession to drink, and I could not leave it alone. And it was so baffling for me at the end that with all the knowledge I have, all the degrees I have, all the books I have written, why is it that I cannot stop drinking? I love my son. And at the end, you know, the love of alcohol took the love of my, you know, I mean, I didn't care for about anything. I remember that I could go pick up my son twice a week when my wife was divorcing me at this time. And I go take him to, like, Toys R Us or a park or restaurant or something. He was about 5-6 years old at this time. And all I had left was this BMW, which I owned a lot of money on it. And I still had my job at university. And I go pick him up, and the 2 hours I was going to be with him, I built myself. I drank as much as I could. I did whatever I needed to do, because the 2 hours I was with him was so important that he doesn't think that I'm an alcoholic or I have any problem. I didn't want to drink the 2 hours. It came to a point that 2 hours I was with him, I could not drink. To me, that was the incomprehensible demoralization they talk about here. So I had this radar detector on my car, and then he would love that I speed, and when we passed by some stores, the alarm would go off or something. And then when he was in the car and I had to drink, so he is in the back seat, and I have him to look through the back window to see if there is any cops around so I can speed. He likes that. And while he was looking through the back window, I would bent over, and I have a sip or a sniff or whatever I had to put in my body. And later on, many years later, when I got sober and I made amends to him, and I told him that, you know, that's what I was doing, you know. He says, Dad, I knew exactly what you were doing. So they know. I had lost everything, and I was just doing some research at university, and I had decided really that I can't go on like this anymore. And you think that maybe, I mean, I was an educated person. I used to teach. And I lived in Chicago for a long time. But the only AA I knew was American Airlines. You know, as much, I mean, I sometimes listen to people, like, you know, they come in and they, you know, this lady in La Jolla was taking a cake, you know, for 25 years. She says, one morning I woke up and I found out that I was putting a little bit too much vodka in my orange juice or oranges in my vodka, and I called the AA Central and somebody came and took me to a meeting, and I have been sober ever since. That hasn't been my case at all. I did not know anything about AA. And that's why, you know, if you are new here, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you have already made it, because I bet you within 2 miles radius from here, there's going to be hundreds of us that are suffering from this disease and they don't know nothing about AA. That's why for me it's so important to stay sober and carry this message to other alcoholics. There are a lot of us out there that they are really suffering, but they don't know there is a way out. My parents, they lived in Chicago, and I had already borrowed money and, you know, everything. My dad, which I could never talk to down him or something, he came to Chicago, and then my mom had asked him to come to Chicago maybe to see, you know, to save me, do something, and I met him at the airport. And I says, did you bring me some money? And he says, no, I came in maybe to take you with us, you know, to San Diego or something. And I told him, get the hell out of here if you didn't bring me in. Actually, it was worse language than that. And I would not dare to talk to this man like that. And I sent him home. I sent him from the airport home. And anyhow, I ended up, you know, I think we all, most of us, we get here maybe with the prayer of an Al-Anon. And one night, I just want to wrap it up here a little faster so I can get to sobriety. One night I have decided to kill myself. And I had a call, and I was in my lab. It was like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I had a gun, and there was a call in my lab. It was my mother from San Diego on the other lane, on the line, and somehow maybe she knew. I don't know. But this woman, to this day, I remember the way she was crying. She asked me to come to San Diego, and I said, you don't understand. I have work to do here. It is my lab and all these things. I have to go. She would not give up. She cried and cried and cried, and I told him, okay, send me a round-trip ticket for one day. You know, and I come to San Diego, the next day I got to come back. So they send me a round-trip ticket. I parked my car, which I own money on it, at O'Hare Airport, and then I flew to San Diego. The next time I went back to Chicago was about 7 years later when I had about 5, 6 years sobriety, you know. And somehow, you know, I ended up in San Diego, and you know, I had lost everything in Chicago. I got into business of sales. I was trying to get a job at one of the universities or colleges, tenure track or something. I have 2 master's degree and, you know, all this work. But I got into sales and I started making good money, and then I got back into drinking a lot worse. And then one day my boss called me in his office and he says, you're an asset to our company, you make a lot of money for the company, but you're going to die. So we want you to go to treatment center. And I didn't know what the treatment center was. But by this time I thought, if somebody, they can take me, get me, you know, keep me out of booze and drugs for 28 days. I can get my head clear, I can get my nose clear, because by this time, no matter how much I drink, I can't get drunk no more. And that's a lonely place. That's the jumping off place. I couldn't imagine life with alcohol or without alcohol. And I went to the McDonald's Center in the treatment center here, and, you know, they took us to AA meeting. That was the best thing happened. I got introduced into Alcoholics Anonymous, and from the beginning somehow, you know, I mean, you know, if... the best thing I heard, like, you know, the old-timers here, when I started going to meetings, was like, you know, are you done or you're not done? You know. And if you're new, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I really hated when I was new and somebody comes from the podium and they give all these messages to new people. I didn't want to listen to anybody. Especially, like, you know, if the guy had like 90 days only. Hey, don't tell me how to stay sober. At least somebody who's got 6 months should tell me how to stay sober. But... you know, I really, you know, I didn't like it much. But if you're new, I have only one message for you. The war is over, and you have lost. The key point for me to stay sober, somebody like me, was I had to surrender. I had lost. I was so much done with alcohol. I was ready to do anything to stay sober. And every action, everything I have done in during my sobriety time, the main purpose for it, for me, has been to stay sober. I just didn't want to drink. I was, the first step, I had no problem. I mean, it was such a big relief for me, the phenomenon of powerlessness. I was like, you know, I was so much at ease that it is not that I'm crazy. At the end, I thought I was crazy that I cannot stop this drinking. That it has, you know, that this is an illness. I have no power. You know, on my own, I get drunk all the time. And, you know, the first step has two parts into it. The first part, that we are powerless over alcohol, that requires honesty. And the second part, which the guys I work, I have to bring it to their attention because it was brought to my attention with my sponsor. There are two parts in the first step. It doesn't say that we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. If that was the case, that means that my life is unmanageable due to drinking. But what the book says, what the first step says, there is a hyphen. It says we are powerless over alcohol, hyphen, that our lives had become unmanageable. My sponsor had me look it up. Hyphen in dictionary means the sentence which follows the first sentence is completely independent of the first sentence. My life has always been unmanageable. The second part requires acceptance and surrender. I mean, the whole, my experience is with Alcoholics Anonymous that every step requires surrender. This whole program is based on surrender. And, you know, I loved it. I used to talk to my sponsor, and then, you know, I told him that, you know, the name Muslim, which doesn't have good reputations nowadays around here, stands for somebody who surrenders to the will of God. That's what the word Muslim stands for. So I used to tell him that as an alcoholic, all of us, probably we are Muslims and we don't even know it. When I got here, I didn't want to hear one word about God because he had betrayed me. When I was going to high school or school, I had a good relationship with him. It's like, God, if I get good grade, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a good guy, you know, to everybody. And I got good grades. Then later on, I got to college. It was about, if she calls, I'm going to do something good, you know. So the scenario changed a little bit. But when I was drinking, at the end of my drinking, I prayed a lot. I prayed on every night. Sitting in my bathroom in La Mesa, I had an apartment the last 8 months of my drinking. And right on Baltimore, and with all the lights off, with all the shades closed, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning. That's the scenario for the last 8 months of my drinking. I'm sitting in the bathroom because there's no window. I feel safe in the bathroom. I'm not that much paranoid. All the lights are off in the rest of the apartment, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning. I have the bottle in one hand. I have the pipe in the other hand. I have done so much blow that my heart is jumping out of my chest, and I say, God, please, I have a son. I don't want to die. Let me live through tonight. I won't do this tomorrow. By 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm by the liquor store. By 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm by my drug dealer's house. And the next night, I'm sitting in the bathroom again doing the same thing, saying, what happened, God? So he betrayed me. I didn't want to hear nothing about God, you know. And then I went through the steps. My first sponsor, you know, God love him. Talk about a sponsor. And then, you know, they asked us, you know, they said, you got to take a sponsor. So I was interviewing maybe people to get a sponsor. I thought, I have 2 postgraduate degrees. At least my sponsor should have, not the PhD, maybe like a couple masters or something. And I asked this guy to be my sponsor, which he was, I think he never finished elementary school or something. And I saw him at the meeting. He was happy. He had like 3-4 years. He was picking up chairs all the time. He was doing something. He was into doing something. And there was a smile on his face. So I asked him to be my sponsor. And for the first 1 year, you know, that he helped me a lot. He got me to action. I remember that I used to go to this meeting in La Jolla. It's called La Jolla Speakers, which is this one here. for about 10 years. And I used to tell, you know, when I got sober, and I thought I'm going to get busy, you know, I got to get my job back, I got to get my wife back. So I used to tell my sponsor, hey, you know, like, you know, man, I got to go back to Chicago, do all these things, you know, dude, you know. And then he would, like, after the meeting, in that speaker's meeting, they give me a coffee can, empty coffee can. Then he had me go pick up cigarette butts in the parking lot, you know, after everybody was gone. I was the floor mopper for 10 years over there. Every Saturday, I mopped the floor. And I thought, how insensitive these sponsors are, you know. I'm trying to get my family back together, you know. The actions I have taken, to me, AA is a no-nonsense program. Absolutely. I try to figure it out. If there are some intellectuals like here, you know, like me, I feel sorry for you. And I mean that, you know, because I had to go through a lot of pain to learn that this program is not about learning at all. This program for me had been to unlearn everything that I knew. And the more I unlearned, the more I let go of everything that I knew, I felt better. This is, you know, my sponsor, you know, is Ken Devaney, and he was here about a month ago, and he was very funny. If you guys saw him, he's really funny. So he's the same way when he sponsors you. Like, you know, I used to call him with my problems. And me and him, with him, you don't have a 5-10 minutes conversation. It's usually about 45 minutes, an hour, 50 minutes conversation. So I call him to tell him my problems. And the way you saw him funny, this guy knows about 100,000 jokes. I don't know how he remembers all these jokes. So he starts telling me all these jokes and make me laugh really hard. I mean that literally my cheeks start hurting laughing so much on telephone. And then, like, you know, 45 minutes, an hour is gone, and we hang up. And then I say, God damn it, he tricked me again. I forgot to tell him my problem. If we want to summarize Alcoholics Anonymous in three words, it's action, action, action. And that's what I was so lucky from the beginning, to get involved into action in this program, you know. I went through the second and the third step without believing God. So if you are like me and you have a problem with God, you know, and we do the steps to have a contact with this higher power or God or something. But as my buddy Frank, an old-timer, which we passed away at from Lemon Grove and Lola Club, he used to say, you don't have to worry about that, having a contact with God. You take the steps, he will contact you. You will be contacted. And that was my case. I started taking the steps because I didn't want to drink no more. My fourth step is like, you know, like was pretty much like everybody else. It took me 6 months and one evening. You know, for 6 months I thought about it. I went to Serenity Shop and I got all the handbooks and everything for the fourth step. And for one evening I put a pencil on the paper and it was done. And I have been fortunate to do a fifth step. When I was about 4 years sober, and I was involved in a small two guys' step study, intimate and a very close step study. And I had a good friend of mine in the program, and she has 10 years more than I, sobriety than I do. And we came to the fifth step. My sponsor at that time was out of the country, and you know, she told me, why don't you do your fifth step with me? And I had done about four steps before that. But I did my fifth step, which I had done a complete sexual inventory with a woman in this program. Where I come from, things like that doesn't happen. And I have had the privilege to sit down and listen to many, many, many fifth steps. And it's a great gift. You know, when I was drinking, I always felt like separate. It was me and the rest of the world. The process of the steps is a process of healing. It works very, very slow. But what it does is that I see myself in everybody and everybody else. You know, that separation has gone away. We are all the same. We are here to take care of each other. And that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people, they have a hard time with fourth and the fifth step. They think it's really the hardest. To me, my favorite step and the hardest one is our sixth step. And I love that step. and the way that step for, works for me, it has taken many, many years practicing that step. And that's what the book talks about. This is the one, the step which separates the men and the boys, you know. It's very hard. The way I could describe this step is this spirituality which we have here, the higher power which we have here, we talk about it here, to me is like a big bone of fire. And I have been in AA long enough. I know what kind of reaction I can, how much action I can take to be comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be sober and comfortable. I know how I can get close to this fire to warm my hands up, to be comfortable. The sixth step is when we have the willingness and we make the ultimate surrender to walk through that fire, to burn, to be discomfortable, to let him mold us any way he wants, to be of service to him and our fellow man. And that's why I like that. I love that step. The seventh step is all about humility. And humility is something that as soon as you talk about it, you don't have it. So I have nothing to say about the seventh step. The eighth and ninth step is about brotherly love and forgiveness here. And I remember that when I was about 8 months sober and I got into the ninth step, and the first thing was, you know, I have, if you are doing the steps, you know, and I have with my guys I sponsored, the easiest part, you know, is financial amounts. But a lot of people, they have a hard time with it. And my sponsor says you're going to send money, child support for your kid. And like every other alcoholic, the first thing I says, no, no, you don't understand. She's going to take all the money for herself, you know, if I send it to, you know, my son was in Chicago with her mother, with his mother. And then I was told that it's none of your business. Your job is to send the money. And I send the money not because I wanted to be a good father or a nice person or something, because I didn't want to drink no more. And I send the money. And then I call all these credit card companies which I own money and, you know, the university and, you know, the rehab, everybody. And I says, well, I made a commitment to send this much money for each one of them. I put them on the paper. And then I told my sponsor, you know what? I have, I'm on a commission, but, you know, I don't know how much money am I going to be making, like, you know, on a monthly basis to pay the all these financial amounts. And it was, you know, and I was told that, you know, just go ahead and do it. That's what I was told, you know. And it's as much as it sounds a little bit out of this world, but every month, the money I needed for financial amounts was there. No matter how much money I made, I was in sales at that time. And, you know, and I thought it came to a point after about I was a year sober, my ex-wife wanted some divorce papers or something, and I don't know if I had it or I wasn't giving it to her or something. I don't remember exactly. But she would not let me talk to my son. And I used to go see my son, and she says, you can't see him and you can't, you know, talk to him. So I went to my sponsor and I says, you know what? I told you about her, like, you know, this is, you know, so it's my right. I'm sober. I'm a citizen now, and I have the right, you know, I'm going to take her to court and have the right of visitation or something, you know, to get my son back. And then they brought my attention to the book, and I was doing the steps at that time, right after the 10th step. It talks about we have ceased fighting everything and everybody. And then I was told to send the money and send a nice letter with it too. And it was very hard for me not to send the money, not to talk to my kid. And I send the letter, and I send the money, and I didn't fight it because I didn't want to drink no more. I wanted to stay sober. And then after about a year and a half, he called me, and his voice had changed. And if he, without exaggeration, if he was standing next to me right now, and I mean that, you would think we are one soul in two bodies. He is my son, he is my buddy, he is my pal, he is everything that I have. Every opportunity we get together. We have traveled New Zealand, Europe together, we have gone everywhere together. And I didn't know, and I thought I had lost my kid. I didn't know by making amends, doing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous one day that he's going to be in my life that I could never imagine. Alcoholics Anonymous process of recovery, it works again, but it's very, very slow. Sometimes we have to sit down in the darkness, you know, and then, you know, like, you know, think about, like, you know, just go through it, you know. I have, I love the 11th step. I have taken it to the extreme. You know, the book talks about that see to it where religion people are right. Make use of what they offer. I have gone back to, I didn't know how to pray. I have gone back to my old religion. I'm not a religion person. You know, I don't, you know, and I have nothing against religion, you know, or religious people, you know. But for me, if somebody asks me, what is my religion? A lot of us, I think, if we are not religious people, I like what Dalai Lama says, is kindness. Our religion, we learn here to be kind. And, you know, I get up in the morning and I get on my knees and I love the 11th step prayers, the St. Francis prayer, and I do the St. Francis prayer. I ask God to keep me sober just for one more day. And I do meditation and I read a lot of other books. But the great, you know, my sponsor has always brought me back to the big book which we have here. Everything, you know, the first 164 pages, it has it everything that I need. The solution to all my problems are in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Russian, I just want to mention this, that as far as the 12 step goes, I always thought that, you know, I own it in the bottom of my heart. I had lost, you know, I have been here for most of my life. And I knew how drugs and alcohol is ruining my back home, where I come from. And I knew it was big over there. So about 10 years ago, I started traveling back home. And I do have been doing that for the last 10 years, and I do that. And I got involved in setting up the meetings over there. And they have the translation of the first 164 pages over there. And I have been working with the GSO about translating, you know, I've been doing some translations. I'm very slow, but we are working on it. You know, when I go over there, it's like, you know, people, they think I'm Bill Wilson himself, like, you know, in the meetings. Like, you know, I mean, you know, there is not, if you read the history of Alcoholics Anonymous in Pasadena and Dr. Bob and good old timers, that, you know, exactly what AA went through when they were in the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what they're experiencing. And I asked my sponsor before I went over there, after the first time I came back, and I says, how am I going to help these people? How am I going to be of service? And he said, as long as your head is into the book, or not to our literature, and your direction is towards God, you will not fail. And I have not failed. We have been given so much here. You know, they don't have a lot of things we have here. They don't have all the literature here, which we have here. They don't have the GSO. They don't have all the sobrieties we have here. But they are so willing to do this. It's just amazing. I have had the privilege setting up, like, you know, taking people through the steps according to the big book, because they don't have the 12 by 12 over there. And I go to different cities and I set up a step study workshop for about 3 days. Almost about 1,500 alcoholics, they show up and we do this. We have the same way, you know, God bless the government, because they are behind us. Because it's the only thing which is working. They see this is working, recovery is working. You know, as much as between the governments, they don't have, you know, the government over there doesn't have that much value for that much for the Eastern, for the Western values over there, and the same thing over there. But it seems to me Alcoholics Anonymous transcends all these things. It's above all these politics, you know. And people over there, they call Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob our grandfathers. They have their pictures over there. And the same way we have meetings here in churches, you know, and, you know, over there we have meetings in the mosques. People are sitting, you know, we have, like, you know, the cross or the Christ on the cross at the churches. Over there we have the pictures of Ayatollahs hanging from the wall, you know. And they do the same thing. They ask me over there, well, how are the meetings over there? And people ask me here, how are the meetings over there? It's the same thing. It's the language of heart. The names are different, but everybody is the same thing they're talking about over there. And you know, what I talk about my sponsor over there a lot, you know, and then they ask me, like, you know, well, we want to see a picture of your sponsor. I had a picture from my sponsor in Ken, like, you know, and I took it back there in one of the houses which they have the meetings over there, and, you know, so they put, you know, that picture up there. And I told Ken, your piece is next to Ayatollah or something. And he gets such a kick out of it. He felt like, you know. But I told him, Ken, I mean, it's good that your picture is up there. But all I'm afraid of, you know, one of these days, you know, you hear a knock on your door from your Department of Homeland Security, you know. And I had nothing to do with it, like, you know. You know. Bill Wilson, in one of his talks, he says this, if I can remember, that AA is not the history of our success stories. Alcoholics Anonymous is about our success stories. AA is the history of our colossal failure through the alchemy of a living, of a grace of a living God, which has turned into the best thing which we have. And I get such a big kick, you know, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, people talk about, you know, I stay sober 2-3 years now. I got the wife I want or the husband I want, you know. I got the house. I have a beautiful car. I have a great job. And I was in a meeting at one of my meetings, and this guy was taking a cake, you know, 20 years cake or something. And he said, you know, I needed like $600-$700 to pay my rent or mortgage, $675, some exact money. And then I went and I opened the mail, and there was a check for exactly the money I needed. Thanks, AA. And they give all this credit to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing wrong with it. But what about when the check is not in mail? What about when you lose your job? What about when the person you love goes marries somebody else? What about when you lose loved ones, your son, and, you know, and you stay sober? That is Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.